From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, big campaign finance rulings from the U.S. Supreme Court are changing the way campaigns are funded.
The temptation to establish these joint fundraising committees to solicit massive amounts of money will be too great to resist.
Plus, could Michigan Democrats be hurting themselves by sticking to the traditions of elections past?
There's an unwritten law that Democrats have to have a black candidate on the ticket, whether that makes any sense or not.
And a father shares how being broken open by his daughter's death has led to living life with true purpose.
When my daughter passed away, what I discovered is I wasn't only going through a grieving process, but I had really lost my purpose in my life.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. We know it's there, everywhere it seems, money in political campaigns. And now with the recent Supreme Court decision in McCutcheon versus Federal Election Commission, we're going to see even more of it. Today on Stateside, what elections in Michigan will look like post-McCutcheon. I'm Cynthia Canty. Also this hour, we talk with author Vic Strecker. He lost his daughter Julia to heart disease when she was 19. That loss sent him on a voyage through philosophy, biology, psychology, literature, neuroscience, and Egyptology.
This book is really about understanding that you have a finite number of years. It may be today, it may be when you're 100, but whatever that is, you want to live those days as if it may be your last day.
We will delve into Vic's new book, On Purpose, later in the show. But first, we're a little more than 4 months away from the statewide primaries, the statewide Republican and Democratic conventions, and some 7 months away from the general election in November. Among many local and congressional races, that's also when Michiganders will go to the polls to choose governor, attorney general, and secretary of state. And Michigan Radio's political analyst Jack Lessenberry has made some interesting observations, particularly about what's shaping up to be the Democratic ticket. Now, Jack, the GOP has things nicely nailed down for November, yes?
Sure, they have all incumbents, and there's some possibility that there might be a Tea Party challenge to the lieutenant governor, Brian Kelly, but that possibility seems to be receding.
But the Democrats have a hole in their ticket.
Well, that's right, and this is they do not have a candidate as of now for Secretary of State. And this brings up some very curious problems because of the traditional sort of multi-ethnic composition of the Democratic Party.
So we know that we've got the governor, we've got Mark Schauer running for governor, Lisa Brown is his lieutenant governor candidate, so he's running mate. AG, you're saying Mark Totten is expected to be chosen at the party convention.
Now, Mark Totten wants it, but there are people in the Democrats who would like to do him out of the nomination just to preserve ethnic balance. There's been a lot of resistance. He's been campaigning hard, the only declared candidate, but the problem is that there's an unwritten law that Democrats have to have a black candidate on the ticket, whether that makes any sense or not. Now, that's not to say there aren't a lot of very qualified black candidates. In fact, the last Democratic Secretary of State, Richard Austin, was an African-American who served in that position for 24 years. But they've also been known to nominate not only African-Americans in hopeless races, but in some cases they've nominated African-Americans who had no chance to win over whites, frankly, who did have a chance to win.
In fact, your piece in Dome, you cited Mary Lou Parks as a fairly
Mary
hapless
Parks,
candidate.
That's right. Now, it's possible that the Democrats could not have won the Secretary of State's office in any event. This is, we're talking about 1998, and the Candace Miller, who's now a congressperson, was the incumbent, and John Austin, who is now the president of the State Board of Education, won. He's only campaigned hard, he was qualified, but Democrats, they needed an African-American. They had white candidates for governor, lieutenant governor, and a white candidate for attorney general named Jennifer Granholm, and so they put Mary Lou Parks on, and it was a disaster. She was a disgrace, frankly, as a candidate, because she didn't campaign. She refused to campaign, and she lost horribly. One of the worst showings in state history, lost by more than 2-1, lost Wayne County, which is unknown for a Democrat. I don't know that anybody would have won, but it was sort of ethnic pandering, and it didn't make Democrats look very good, and I don't think it made them look very good with minorities.
And this ethnic pandering shot them in the foot again with the 8 years later.
That was actually a much more serious case. We had a man named Scott Bowen, who was a judge from Grand Rapids, resigned his judgeships, wanted to be attorney general, and Mike Cox at the time, the incumbent Republican attorney general, was pretty shaky. He had had this bizarre thing where he admitted to having an affair and claimed people were trying to blackmail him, and some of his decisions were shaky. He was the only, when he had won, it was the first time a Republican had won a candidate, had won a race for attorney general in the state in 60, in more than 50 years, 50 years, I think. So, but Granholm and Mark Brewer intervened to give the nomination to a man named Amos Williams, who was a very nice man. He'd been a policeman. He was kind of a less well-known attorney, but he didn't have funding. He didn't have any sort of presence, and he lost badly to Mike Cox. They said at the time, there were people who said at the time, well, they didn't think Bowen was an acceptable candidate because he was anti-abortion. But I don't know that that's exactly. He certainly was had more qualifications on paper to be attorney general than Amos Williams did, and they felt that they had to have a black presence on the on the ticket, even if that was going to end up costing them something.
So there we go. So you had an African American candidate who just sank into oblivion. So what do you see happening this time around?
Well, I hope that Democrats, now they have a new chairman named Lon Johnson, I hope they're going to be big enough or strong enough to feel that they don't need to do this sort of thing of having, sort of a flavor of the month for every position on their ticket. As you pointed out, they have two white men, they have one white woman who happens to be Jewish, so the only part of their coalition not represented is the African Americans. But I would hope that we're in an age now, and I think Democrats should realize, we have an African American president of the United States. We have a case where the Detroit electorate, which is overwhelmingly African American, elected a white mayor, and so candidly, one of their problems is finding anybody to run for Secretary of State. I think if you expressed any interest in the nomination, Cindy, you could have it. They don't have anybody. And part of the reason is Ruth Johnson is generally well thought of. In some circles, she's better thought of than the Attorney General, Bill Schuette, or even the governor. She was the one Republican to take sort of a principled stand on disclosure of this sort of secret campaign money, and the legislature overruled her. But I see no, and she is well-funded. It's very, very unlikely. The only time in living memory that a Secretary of State lost was when Richard Austin ran against Candace Miller in a very Republican year and indicated on television that he was not as mentally sharp as he used to be. And it was fairly embarrassing for him. And but that, again, incumbents in these races, especially Republican incumbents, do not lose. And we should have mentioned another thing that a lot of voters don't realize. Candidates in Michigan for Secretary of State and Attorney General are not chosen by the voters in a primary. They are chosen by party officials, some would say party hacks, others would say citizens, at the Republican and Democratic state conventions, which are held around the time of Labor Day. So those people will decide who our candidates for Attorney General will be, and Secretary of State and Lieutenant Governor, not us.
I get the sense from your column in Dome Magazine, Jack, that the Democrats are looking for a term-limited black legislator whom they'll pop up there and then give no money to because they need the money for the governor's race and certainly for replacing Carl Levin's Senate seat, filling that seat. So put you up there and then good luck to you.
Well, that's the case. They have to husband their resources, and both parties do, but Democrats especially, and the governors and Senate races are going to suck pretty much all the money out of the room. Now, again, I would like them to prove me wrong and nominate. Now, I will say that in 2002, when the Secretary of State's race looked hopeless, they nominated Carmela Sabaw, who was the Macomb County clerk, and she ran she lost pretty badly, but she ran a decent campaign. She was a qualified candidate. She was absolutely nothing to be ashamed of, and there are certainly county clerks in this state who are Democrats or other people who have this kind of experience who would be certainly very reputable candidates, and you never know. The one thing about elections is you never know. The opposing candidate could, God forbid, die, could be caught up in some scandal.
Sure.
We have seen this happen before, and I think that both parties, Republicans and Democrats, have an obligation to give us candidates who could do the job if possible. And Democrats are not only to fault in this. They are here, but there are a lot of races where you have safe Democratic seats, and Republicans put on some non-entity, in some cases nobody. Sometimes in the legislature they don't nominate anybody right against the incumbents, and I guess I'm enough of a public-spirited citizen to think that's wrong.
Jack, what do you think the consequences for voters have been from this this race and gender quota system that that you feel the Dems have?
Well, there's a time when it made sense, and it certainly is late. In 2002, when Jennifer Granholm ran for governor, there were a lot of people, turnout was fairly large, there were a lot of people who were excited because a woman was running for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly in the 60s and the 70s, and even in President Obama's first election, there are a lot of people who rushed to the polls because they finally had the chance to vote for an African-American candidate for whatever job. But, you know, I think that we've matured beyond that, and to think that if you were to put that the black people are going to mindlessly vote for an African-American candidate is sort of insulting to everybody, and it's not even clear that I don't think, frankly, I hate to break it to them, but I don't think anybody is excited about who the Secretary of State of Michigan is, and I would guess that if you went out on the street with a microphone right now, you would find that not a whole lot of people could name who the Secretary of State of Michigan is.
I think most people just want to be able to get in and out of that office when you want to get your license tabs and not take 2 hours.
That's right. If I was running for Secretary of State, what I would do is offer to streamline it and put more bathrooms in every Secretary of State's office. I probably would be elected for life if I could do that, based on my own personal experience getting my license plates renewed.
Michigan Radio's political analyst, Jack Lessenberry. As always, Jack, thank you so much.
Always a pleasure, Cindy.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, now that spring is really, really here and the warmer temps are chasing away the last traces of all that heavy snow, homeowners around the state are keeping watchful eyes on their basements, worried about flooding. And my next guest knows a thing or two about flooding and Michigan basements. He's a builder, a former home inspector in Oakland County, and his new book is Five Steps to a Dry Basement or Crawl Space. Ronald Gay, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Is there something about soil in Michigan that makes the state more prone to leaky basements than other states?
This was a lot of marshland. When they first explored this after the War of 1812, they first came into the area and said this wasn't habitable because there was so much wet ground and so many wetlands and swamps. They didn't go far enough north to Oakland County and find out that it eventually dried out. But if you go up Woodward Avenue from Detroit, that was a large swamp there from Ferndale all the way up to Birmingham, essentially.
So basically southern Oakland County was very swampy.
Yep.
Yeah.
And same with even on the east side. And it's a lot of clay soils.
So what are things that people are doing or are not doing or they're doing wrongly in managing that surface water?
Well, I think one of the things that we're all guilty of, we see products for sale in stores that are by the cash register or on the end cap, and because they're there, we think that they're, you know, bona fide.
So what kinds of products are we talking about? Because I probably have fallen prey to buying some
of
those.
So here's a real common one. Yeah. Splash blocks are what goes underneath the downspout, with the downspout from your gutter, the vertical piece there. So if you go into the big box stores, you'll see all kinds of splash blocks, but they're all plastic ones. So the plastic splash blocks, they literally blow away in heavy winds. They get kicked around by kids playing. They get knocked loose by lawnmowers, lawn crews. So that's a good example. That seems very commonsensical looking at it. That's a splash block. You know, why wouldn't this work?
Sure.
But the plastic ones are really bad.
So we should buy
concrete splash blocks like they used to use. That's all they used in the past before plastics became so common for everything.
All right.
So they are out there.
That's an easy thing to do.
Yeah. Another one is weed barriers. This is the fabric or plastic that people put underneath. They more often put it under stone.
Yes.
To keep the weeds down.
Yeah.
It's a very big problem with basement seepage. It acts like a pan, and it collects water. And as soon as the fabric or the plastic collects enough water, and it'll spill over the edge and run down the foundation wall. So I say do not have any of that within 10 feet of your foundation. So a couple of examples there.
Those are good ones. What proactive things could people be doing? And now that they're looking at their yards, it's spring, planning ahead, what do we watch for and what should we steps should we take?
Well, the real common thing, if you have water coming in the corner of your basement, and it's very commonly in the corners because that's where the downspouts are, you need to go outside and look at your yard and see what's going on with the gutter and the downspout particularly and the garden in that area and see what the grade is like. One of the myths out there is that if you just raise the grade all the way around your house, it'll solve all your problems.
I've heard that.
That's not true. Okay. I mean, it's really important where the concentrations of water are. So this would be downspouts, hard surfaces like patios, even small little patios by doors and things. Little pieces of concrete like that even can be a problem if they're slanted towards the house. So the grade, if you go out and look at that area where you have your problem in that corner of the basement and correlate what's going on outside there, you might be able to figure it out.
Managing that surface water. The book is Five Steps to a Dry Basement or Crawl Space by Ronald K. Gay. And Ronald is a former home inspector. He's a builder, so he certainly knows whereof he speaks. And thank you so much for sharing your insights with us, Ron.
Thanks for having me today.
The death of a child, it's one of the greatest blows anyone will have to bear. And it would be so understandable if that parent crumbles into his or her grief, becomes filled with sorrow and anger. But when my next guest lost his 19-year-old daughter, Julia, to heart disease, that experience of being broken open sent him on a voyage through philosophy, biology, psychology, literature, neuroscience, Egyptology, and more. Vic Strecker has turned his journey of self-discovery and growth into a remarkable graphic story called On Purpose, Lessons in Life and Health from the Frog, the Dung Beetle, and Julia. So good to have you with us here, Vic.
Thanks so much, Cindy.
So give us a sense of what this journey is that Vic in this book is taking along with Julia, whom we meet in the book.
Well, when my daughter passed away, what I discovered is I wasn't only going through a grieving process, but I had really lost my purpose in my life. And I hadn't really thought about purpose in life all that much until I started reading about it. And I initially read about it.
So you didn't think about it till it went away?
No, that's exactly right. Okay. No, I really had never thought about this concept of purpose in life. And quite honestly, if I had, I probably would have thought it's a little bit mushy. And then I started discovering that people who have a very low purpose in life actually end up much more likely to get sick physically and in terms of their mental health. They're far more likely to become depressed 10 years later, far more likely to develop suicidal ideation. But at the same time, people with a low purpose in life are more likely to suffer heart attacks, stroke, even get Alzheimer's disease 7 years later. There's a very nice study done of that in Chicago. So I started looking at this from a scientific perspective. Then I decided to go back into the philosophy of this. So you can go all the way back to Aristotle. You can go back to the Stoic philosophers such as Seneca or Marcus Aurelius. And then you can go, of course, into the existential philosophers. Mm-hmm. The existentialists focused on purpose in life, and they felt that you had to have a purpose in life.
And as you say, you felt like after Julia died, you lost that. And we see you on purpose in this book in that slump that you had to pull yourself up by the bootstraps and try to move on. So you share your journey in doing that.
Well, I decided to be as honest as I could about that, and that wasn't a pretty picture. For the first 6 months or so, I struggled mightily in just trying to become a human being again. And I have met, since I wrote this book, literally hundreds of people who have lost individuals and their lives. And this book isn't just about loss, by the way.
Right.
Actually, it's quite a positive book about purpose.
About purpose,
but
yeah.
I have met a lot of people who have gone through that road, down that road, and it's a big club.
So as you try to discover what it means to have purpose, and as you say, lessons in life and health from the Frog, the Dung Beetle, and Julia, What is that purpose that we're looking for if we don't have it?
Well, I view purpose as a higher order set of goals that you might have. A goal might be, I want to swim across the swimming pool that's 25 meters. Mm-hmm. Or a goal might be, I want to get my Bachelor of Science degree, or whatever that is. But a purpose in life is something that may not even be achievable. And it's usually a collection of different goals that are put together. But I call it a meta goal, something much, much higher order. And in general, the way I think about a purpose, it's generally a self-transcending goal. In other words, it's something bigger than yourself. It's not just focused on you. A purpose in life could have some elements that are related to you, but in general, it's related to things that are bigger than yourself.
And as you say, the science supports that people with this kind of this purpose that transcends my needs have better health.
There's a study that was recently done that had Elizabeth Blackburn in the authorship. Elizabeth Blackburn's the 2009 Nobel laureate in medicine, and she discovered telomeres. Telomeres are the ends of our chromosomes. She discovered the process that the ends of our chromosomes, these telomeres, actually keep our chromosomes, our DNA, repaired. And when our chromosomes start shortening, we actually start getting sick and we die. And what she did was put people into a three-month meditation program. She had a weightless control group, in other words, a group waiting to meditate for those 3 months, but they were just put on this waiting list, and that was the control condition. And they found that the people in the meditation group had greater repair of their DNA, greater repair of their telomeres. But what was very important is that it wasn't the meditation. It was the meditation produced a greater purpose in people's lives, and it was the purpose in life that actually repairs your DNA.
Wow.
So we also know that people who have a stronger self-transcending set of values become less defensive about change. So if I ask a person to quit smoking, or that they suggest that they need to quit smoking, I can try to scare them, for example, and I don't believe
that. A popular tactic.
Yeah, and I just don't believe that works very well. Mm-hmm. And I think we move into this negative vortex. We could pay them, and, after that they say, well, what do you pay me to lose weight? To me, that's another negative vortex. What works really well, interestingly enough, is if you simply ask that smoker to start thinking about their self-transcending values that they have that is related to purpose in life. And as they start contemplating those values, they literally become less defensive, which is very interesting. So we've started even monitoring this using fMRI, or functional magnetic resonance mm-hmm. imaging. So while people are in the scanner, we're scanning their brain, and we start asking them to start repeating their core values. And when that happens, they end up becoming less defensive, and they end up they change their behaviors.
And I think a lot of us would be hard-pressed if someone said, what are your core values? I don't know. I think that's something that
what do you think? Do you think your family is part of your core value?
Sure.
Care? Okay.
Yeah, yeah. And you take us through that in your
book. How
about
creativity?
Yes.
How about independence?
Yeah. So we could throw out
a lot of different core values, and you might say, I care less about mm-hmm. security, but more about my community.
Yes.
Or the opposite. Or I care a lot about kindness and empathy. I care less about tradition or more about tradition. I care more or less about money. The idea is that all of us have different values. Some of those values are self-enhancing values, like money, mm-hmm. Your appearance, whether you're famous or not. And then there are others that I would consider self-transcending.
Yes, it's fascinating discussion. If you just joined us, I'm talking with Victor Strecker, and he is a professor at the University of Michigan School of Public Health. But today he's here as the author of the book On Purpose, Lessons in Life and Health from the Frog, the Dung Beetle, and Julia. Julia being the 19-year-old daughter that you lost to heart disease, and it really sent you on this incredible journey. And I have to say, something I never thought I would be discussing in any interview, a delightful dung beetle named Winston. Why the dung beetle?
Okay, as I was thinking about this book as a journey,
Yes. You
think about Joseph Campbell and you think about the hero's journey and you think about a lot of the movies and books that were generated from this concept of a journey. Mm-hmm. And if you think about Star Wars, you know, who was the sage? There's always a sage or an oracle these journeys. And who was the sage in Star Wars? It was Yoda.
Yoda.
How about in Pinocchio?
Jiminy Cricket.
Jiminy
Cricket,
remember?
Was our sage.
Okay,
absolutely.
So he's an insect.
Yes,
he's a little cricket,
yes.
Right? So I started thinking that I better have a sage or an oracle in this particular journey. So I was in the British Museum and I discovered this scarab. In fact, if you go around the British Museum, half of it seems to be related to Egyptian artifacts. And you see these scarabs everywhere, and the scarabs are pushing this sun up all the time. And it turns out that the scarab god, Khepri, was their number one god, and he was in charge of transformation, rebirth, and transcendence. And he would push the sun out of darkness, the night, which they called chaos. Mm-hmm. And of course, chaos happened to me. It happens to – it happened to Julia. It happens to everybody, quite honestly. And then he would push the sun up out of chaos every morning. And so he was in charge of rebirth. And so I started doing a little research on this scarab because I thought, well, maybe I'll have a scarab in this book.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that the model for the scarab was the dung beetle.
How
now,
humble.
Can you imagine these ancient Egyptians? They're just looking on the desert floor and watching these dung beetles roll their big ball of poo forward, and they're going, that's going to be our number one god.
Isn't that something? what we're learning from this humble little beetle?
Well, it's interesting. The family name of the dung beetle is Scarabidae. The other part of this concept of the dung beetle is that dung beetles literally are born into poop. In a giant ball of poop. And I thought lots of us are. Lots of people in our world are born into severe poverty or poop or dysfunctional families. Or things happen to us. And what I loved about dung beetles, they're really a charming creature. They take that poop and they turn it into a purpose. And I just thought this is a neat metaphor for me. And you know, if you can have Jiminy Cricket as a sage, I can have,
Winston
the dung beetle
and Winston does
as my sage.
He certainly takes it through. Did you, in the process of making this journey, and I love that term you use about being broken open, has it left you not fearing death? In fact, I know you quote Steve Jobs telling us death is very likely the single best invention of life. It's life's change agent.
You know, for a while after Julia died, I'll just be honest, I didn't care if I lived. I wasn't feeling suicidal, but I really didn't care at all if lightning struck me and, you know, I went down immediately. And I started studying the Stoic philosophers, and there are a few wonderful books about them, and then reading them, the original books from Seneca, from Marcus Aurelius, they would wake up in the morning and say, I think I'm going to die today. And when I started reading about this, I thought, really? And what they would do in thinking they would die that morning or that day, they would live a bigger life. So they realized that the finiteness of our lives is very much like the finiteness of any resource. If we have $10 and somebody asks for $5, it's harder to give them than if we have $10,000. Well, Marcus Aurelius literally said, don't live your life as if you're going to live 10,000 years. And I started thinking about this from the perspective of public health and medicine. And you know what we keep doing? We extend life, which is fine. The country that has the highest life expectancy, Japan, also has the highest suicide rate. And that struck me. You know, what are we doing in our field of public health and in medicine? We're starting to promise people a second century of life. That's what we're doing
we
now.
We are. You're
That's
right.
the promise of medicine now. And What would we be doing in that 200 years? Would we just watch more Kardashian sisters? Would we watch every Miley Cyrus twerking video three times now? I mean, in other words, would we spread our meaninglessness in our lives over a longer period of time? And that's what I was really concerned about. So this book is really about understanding that you have a finite number of years. It may be today. It may be when you're 100. But whatever that is, you want to live those days as if it may be your last day. You want to live every day to a maximum. And it's something that Julia taught me because when she came down with a virus when she was one, she needed a heart transplant. We had no idea how long she would live. And in knowing that we didn't know, we lived a big life with her. And that transformed me as well.
Her 19 years. Well, it is a remarkable book, On Purpose, Lessons in Life and Health from the Frog, the Dung Beetle, and Julia. And we've been talking with the author, Vic Strecker, of the University of Michigan School of Public Health. And it is, it's a remarkable graphic story. And I think it's something that you read and then you keep nearby as you kind of go through your own life's journey. And I want to thank you so much for sharing yours with us.
Thank you so much, Cindy.
Welcome back to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. When the U.S. Supreme Court recently handed down its 5-4 decision in McCutcheon versus Federal Election Commission, it struck down the overall limits on just how much donors can give to federal candidates, parties, and political action committees. Writing for the majority, Chief Justice John Roberts pointed to free speech, saying that trumps concerns about who's getting a bigger voice in government. Writing in dissent, Justice Stephen Breyer argued that decision harms basic First Amendment rights for everyday citizens, their right to be heard at all in our political process. Well, now that the dust has settled, we wondered what it means going forward for elections in Michigan. We're joined now by Rich Robinson. He's the executive director of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network. Rich, always good to have you on Stateside. Explain just what the McCutcheon ruling did.
Thanks, Cindy. Good to be with you.
So explain for us exactly what the McCutcheon ruling did.
Well, the McCutcheon decision answered a challenge to the aggregate limit of what an individual could give to all federal political committees. So that's candidate committees, the national political party committees, each party has three, and political action committees. And the limit that was overturned by this decision was that an individual could give $123,200 or $600 in a two-year election cycle.
To all of those, thus the term aggregate.
To all of those. And there were prescribed limits as far as how much of that could be given to candidate committees. That was a limited number within that overall limit, how much could go to party committees and all of that. So this overturned that limit and said that now individuals are free to give as much to in aggregate as they want, but there's still a limit in place, at least for now, on how much an individual could give to an individual committee, so an individual's candidate committee, or you could give no more than $5,000 a year to a political action committee of the sort that donates to candidates. Of course, now we have super PACs where they're confined to making independent expenditures, and there are no limits on what an individual or a corporation can give to those super PACs.
Well, Rich, where did these aggregate limits come from? When did they get put into place, and why? Now they're gone now, but what was it that caused them to be put into place?
Well, the aggregate limits go back to the post-Watergate reforms. Mm-hmm. And those reforms instituted limits on what could be given to committees. They instituted limits on spending by committees that were subsequently overturned in a Supreme Court case called Buckley against Vallejo. And then they put in place an aggregate limit. Now, the aggregate limits were revisited in the McCain-Feingold reforms of 2002 and made to comport with more contemporary kinds of economics. So they were updated, made to be a greater amount. More recently, they had been given a kind of a consumer price index, so they increased it each election cycle. And the point of it all was to limit how much influence an individual could exercise over politics in general. And a lot of the testimony at the time, those limits were challenged in the case of McConnell against mm-hmm. Federal Election Commission. The testimony was such that this is corrupting in the sense of making office holders, legislators beholden to individual contributors, warping the judgment of office holders and so forth. But that wasn't convincing to the Roberts Court and the majority that made this decision in McCutcheon.
In fact, Chief Justice Roberts clearly expressed that it deprived Americans of the chance for robust expression of their First Amendment rights, and that they believe that that aggregate limit didn't do anything to prevent corruption. So let's just explore that view for a moment. Is it fair? Is it constitutional if I want to support the candidate of my choice in the way I choose to do it? Is it constitutional and fair to say, no, you can't?
Well, this has to do with what is corruption. Hmm. And the very narrow definition that the court now applies is the only corruption that can be regulated is quid pro quo corruption, the actual buying of a vote. And this standard of corruption was introduced in the Citizens United case in 2010. At that point, the Roberts Court said we can only regulate quid pro quo corruption. And at that time, they were talking about independent expenditures, and they said, well, an independent party spending has no opportunity really for quid pro quo corruption because they're not giving to a candidate, and there's no danger of corruption there. Well, they've taken it now and extended it to giving directly to candidate committees and party committees and so forth. And it was almost a tautology in the logic, saying, well, we told you that last time, and now quid pro quo is the only thing we can regulate. Justice Breyer, writing in dissent, mm-hmm. said, you know, this is a decision that's best left to those who have experience in politics, legislators. And when they were last asked on this, they had a very definite opinion that there was more to corruption than simple vote buying. And Justice Breyer made the opinion that judges are poorly qualified to recognize the corrupting influence of money in politics. So in effect, he was saying, you're legislating from the bench here. You're not well equipped to do this, but this new understanding of what political corruption is really taken hold now in two consecutive decisions from the Supreme Court.
I'm speaking with Rich Robinson, who's executive director of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network, as we talk about the recent Supreme Court ruling in McCutcheon versus Federal Election Commission that struck down the overall limits on just how much that wealthy donors can give to candidates, parties, and political action committees, this aggregate limit idea. And in your piece that you wrote recently for Dome about this decision, you were referring to that case in 2003, McConnell versus the FEC, and I was first struck with the statement by then Senator Fred Thompson of Tennessee, and he wrote that we've gone from basically a small donor system where the average person believed they had a stake, believed they had a voice, to one of extremely large amounts of money where you're not a player unless you're in the $100,000 to $200,000 range or more. And that was 10 years ago, wasn't it?
It was. And what then Senator Thompson was talking about was when senators were engaged in soft money fundraising for the political parties. They weren't raising the money for their own campaign committees. No one could give their own campaign committee that much.
Mm-hmm.
But he was saying in acting on behalf of the party and raising this, it's corrupting to the individual who's involved in the fundraising. And this another interesting aspect of this thing is Justice Breyer challenged the notion that the limits on contributions to an individual candidate or an individual committee would be sufficient to curb corruption because he made the point money can simply be transferred from one committee to the next to the next. And even though in the new era now where we're talking about a new monster called a joint fundraising committee, even though that's ostensibly not for the solicitor of the money, it could all be transferred back to the direct benefit of that individual. So his question then is that not corrupting? Now, Chief Justice Roberts responded that the scenario that Breyer had laid out was divorced from reality. But in fact, Justice Breyer actually demonstrated in a table, in an appendix to the opinion, exactly how it could work. And it wasn't divorced from reality at all. In fact, it was a relatively elementary example of the kind of money laundering that goes on in American politics.
So where do we stand today after McCutcheon? You just referred to this, as you call it, the monster called the Enhanced Joint Fundraising Committee. What is that, and why are we going to be seeing a lot more of it since McCutcheon?
Well, it puts a political party or an individual in a position where they can solicit a great amount of money from an individual donor. A lot of attention was paid in the initial analysis here that an individual member of Congress could go and solicit from an individual donor a contribution, maximum contributions for every candidate his party had for Congress, as well as for the party's three political committees, the federal parties. And that would add up to a total of $3.6 million. And isn't that a lot? But that left out of the equation the whole matter of leadership PACs. Virtually everyone in Congress has a leadership PAC, and you could solicit for those committees as well. So it's actually more in line that you could, an individual member of Congress could solicit $5 million from an individual donor, or a lot more, because that donor can give money to every PAC, and pass it around. Maybe it's transferred back to the benefit of the individual solicitor. Probably it goes to where it's needed, but it gives that individual an awful lot of leverage within his own caucus. It gives an awful lot of leverage to the individual donor. And that's the kind of view of corruption that previously held sway with the United States Supreme Court. And I trace a lot of this back now, this kind of new thinking that, you know, money is pure and you just have to let the money have its way, to the retirement of Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. Mm. She was the one justice in the U.S. Supreme Court who actually had experience as an elected office holder. She'd been a state senator in Arizona, and she had a very different view from her replacement on the court, Samuel Alito, and from the majority that now prevails in these cases.
What effect do you expect or fear that we're going to see in Michigan because of McCutcheon?
Well, I think the temptation to establish these joint fundraising committees to solicit massive amounts of money will be too great to resist. And certainly there are donors who are capable of writing checks into the seven figures or even eight figures as far as that goes. So I think you may see chairmanships in Congress being decided on the basis of who can raise money. I think you may see the legislative agenda of an individual or a small group of individuals or an interest group having even more leverage in the legislative process than they've had up to this point. And I don't consider this to be the end of where this campaign finance deregulation is going. I think the Roberts Court, as long as it stays intact with five members, is going to do more than what they've done already.
Are there more cases in the pipeline?
Well, a case applied for certiorari and was denied just last week or the week before. This came from Iowa. Iowa has limits on allows unions to make contributions to political candidates, but not corporations.
Mm-hmm.
That was challenged by Iowa Right to Life, and the court did not grant certiorari in that case. I have a sense that that was a matter of timing, not a matter of this isn't something we want to take up. That was a case that was designed to open it up to corporations being able to make direct contributions to political candidates. That prohibition presently is still in place. But I think there's a timing matter in all of this, and how much Chief Justice Roberts thinks the American public will tolerate in any one decision. You know, when they first started to unravel the McCain-Feingold reforms, the initial decision was one called Wisconsin Right to Life against Federal Election Commission that first allowed corporate money to be involved in so-called issue advertising. And at the time of that decision, Justice Scalia really wanted it to go farther than just letting corporate money speak in issue advocacy. He wanted it to be the ability that was permitted by Citizens United, the ability to say explicitly, vote for a candidate. And he chided Chief Justice Roberts at the time for faux judicial modesty. And he said, that's really judicial obfuscation. But I think Roberts was parsing this out in kind of digestible segments that now we're to the point where a lot of limits have been rolled back. And I think this limit on against corporate contributions is going to be rolled back eventually, and probably the idea of limits to an individual committee as well. Notably, Mitch McConnell has already received a number of contributions in his election campaign this year that exceed the limit on a contribution to a candidate's committee. I think this is setting things up for McConnell to be the plaintiff again against limits on contributions to an individual candidate committee and probably to any political committee. So the ultimate goal is just let money have its way.
Hmm. Rich Robinson, executive director of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network, as we dissect McCutcheon versus Federal Election Commission. Rich, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me, Cindy. I'm sure that cheered up your listeners.
Thanks, Rich. Okay, now from loads of money to loads of rosies. Just a few weeks ago, March 29th to be exact, hundreds of women of all ages donned their coveralls and tied their hair up with bandanas and headed to the Yankee Air Museum at Willow Run Airport in Southeast Michigan. Well, now it's official. That gathering has set the Guinness World Record. 778 Rosie the Riveters all in one place. It was the Yankee Air Museum's second try at setting the Guinness World Record for the most women and girls dressed as Rosies, and second try was a charm. But the serious business continues of raising enough money to save the historic Willow Run bomber plant from demolition. The Yankee Air Museum's trying to raise $8 million to buy the old plant from the Racer Trust, which oversees liquidation of unwanted former GM properties. The museum has until May 1st to save the bomber plant from the wreckers ball. The original Rosies, of course, turned out B-24 Liberator heavy bombers at the plant during World War II.
All the day long, whether rain or shine, she's a part of the assembly line. She's making history, working for victory. Rosie, the Riveter, keeps a sharp lookout for sabotage. Sitting up there on the fuselage, that little frail can do more than a male can do. Rosie, the Riveter, Rosie's got a boyfriend, Charlie. Charlie, he's a Marine.
Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Peg Watson. Contributors are Allie Billings, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Chris Hattelsey, Mercedes Mejia, Katie Suha, Claire Tennisgetter, and Jeff Warniak. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening, and let's talk tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock.